quickly decided to crack some of the nuts and thus perhaps give a little lesson in biology. It would be taking advantage of the children's own curiosity and would be following up something that they themselves had initiated. He sent Walt outside for 2 stones to use in cracking the hard shells. Walt returned with 2 half-bricks, bricks and stones not being distinguished in his vocabulary. Ish ignored that detail, but he found that trying to break the hard shells with a brick was more likely to result in a smashed finger than a smashed nut. He cast around for something better to use, and his eyes fell upon his hammer. It was standing, as usual, on the mantelpiece. "Go get the hammer for me, Chris," he said, pointing to the little boy who was nearest it. Usually, Chris was only too glad to spring up from his seat and do something active, but now a strange thing occurred. Chris glanced this way and that, at Walt and at Weston, who were next to him. He looked embarrassed or alarmed. "Go get the hammer, Chris," Ish repeated, thinking that possibly Chris had been daydreaming and had merely heard his name without noting the words that went before.
I don't want to,
said Chris hesitantly. Chris was 8 years old and not given to being a crybaby, and yet Ish could see that Chris was, for some reason, close to tears. He dropped the matter with Chris. "Bring me the hammer, one of you others," he said. Weston looked at Walt, and Barbara and Betty, the sisters, looked at each other too. Those 4 were the oldest. All 4 of them looked back and forth and did not make a move to rise. Naturally, the little ones did nothing, but Ish could see all the children glancing furtively at each other. Although Ish was wholly puzzled, he saw no reason to make an issue of the matter, and he was just about to get the hammer himself when something else strange began to happen. Joey rose. He walked over toward the mantelpiece. All the children's eyes followed him. The room, Ish realized, was deathly quiet. Joey stood at the mantelpiece. He reached out his hand and took the hammer. There was a strange little cry from one of the smaller girls. In the hush that followed, Joey walked back from the mantelpiece and gave the hammer to Ish. Joey went back to where he had been sitting. The room was still, and the children were looking at Joey. Joey sat down, and Ish broke the silence by pounding on a nut with the hammer. At that noise, the tension, whatever it was, seemed to break. Only after it had come to noon, and he dismissed school, did Ish have time to think the matter over and come, with a start, to the conclusion that it had been a case of pure superstition. The hammer. All the children associated it vaguely with something strange and mystical in the far past. It was used on state occasions. It stood on the mantelpiece by itself. Generally speaking, no one touched it except Ish. Even Bob, Ish now remembered, had handled it with reluctance on that occasion when they had started out with the dog teams. The children had come to think of it an implement of power, dangerous for any of them to touch. He could see how such an idea might have begun half seriously as a game, and in a few years have come to be taken seriously. And as for Joey, again he realized that Joey was the one who stood out from the crowd. Perhaps Joey had not rationally figured out that Ish's hammer was only like any other hammer. Perhaps he had merely let his superstition work at a higher level and assumed that he had something in common with his father, such as was shown by his reading, so that he, as the high priest's child, the son of the blessing, might touch the relics which would blast the others. Possibly even, he might be capable of it. Joey had helped build up the superstition in the others in order to build up his own importance. It could not be much work, Ish decided, to overcome this superstition. Yet that same afternoon, he began to have doubts. On the sidewalk in front of the house, some children were playing. As they played, they were jumping from one block of the sidewalk to another and crying out that old rhyme, "Step on a crack, break your mother's back." Ish had heard children singing it often in the old times. It meant nothing then, just a little childish rhyme. Children, as they got older, had always learned that such things were merely childish. But now, he thought, what would there be to teach the children that such things were mere superstition? Here was a society with almost no stored-up tradition, and apparently a society that was not going to develop its traditions greatly by reading. He sat in his easy chair in the living room and heard the children outside playing and shouting their rhyme. As the smoke of his cigarette curled up, he remembered more and more disturbing evidences of superstition. Ezra carried his pocket piece, the old Victorian penny, and doubtless the children looked on that much as they looked on the hammer. Molly was a confirmed rapper on wood. Ish was disturbed when, now that he considered, he remembered, the children also rapping on wood. Would they ever learn that that was just the thing that someone did to make himself feel more comfortable, although it had no real meaning? Yes, he reluctantly concluded, this matter of the children's beliefs was extremely serious. In the old times, the beliefs held by the children of any family or small group of families might be momentous enough, but still those children, on growing up, would come into contact with other beliefs and make adjustments. Besides, there had been a great, even overwhelming, mass of tradition. The tradition of Christianity, or of Western civilization, or of Indo-European folkways, or of Anglo-American culture. Call it what you wished. It was still so tremendous that you might say it was omnipotent, for good or bad, absorbing the individual. But now their little community had lost much of the tradition. Part of it had been lost because no seven survivors, Evie did not count, could preserve and transmit all of it. Part had been lost because for so long a time there had been no big children to pass on the tradition to the small ones. The oldest of the younger generation had been taught games by their parents, not by older comrades. The community should therefore be plastic to an unprecedented degree. This was an opportunity, but also a responsibility, and a danger. It would be a danger, and he shuddered at the thought, if any evil force, such as a demagogue, should begin to work. To be sure, he recollected Riley, he had not found the children particularly plastic as regards learning to read. Yet that might be only that a stronger force, the whole environment, was already working against his efforts. But take now again this matter of superstition. Perhaps this all had grown up because, as it happened, there was no one in the tribe who was creatively religious. Perhaps there was some kind of vacuum in the childish mind, and it had to be filled up with supernatural beliefs. Perhaps all this represented some kind of subconscious straining toward an explanation of the basis of life itself. Years ago, they had organized those church services and then discontinued them as meaningless. That discontinuance might have been a mistake. Now, more certainly even than before, he knew that he had the opportunity to be the founder of a religion for a whole people. What he told the children in school, they would probably believe. He could ensure their memory of it by mere insistence and iteration. He could tell them that the Lord God created the world in 6 days and found it good. They would believe. He could tell them a local Indian legend that the world was the work of Old Man Coyote. They would believe. Yet, what could he really tell them, in honesty? He might tell them any one of half a dozen theories of cosmogony which he remembered from his old studies. Probably they would believe these too, although their complications did not make for quite as good a story as one of those others. Actually, no matter what he said, it might easily be twisted and made into some kind of religion. Again, as years before, he revolted from the idea, for he treasured the honesty of his own skepticism. It's better, he thought in words, remembering some bit of reading, to have no opinion of God at all than to have one that is unworthy of him. He lighted another cigarette and settled back into the chair again. Yet this matter of the vacuum, it worried him. Unless it could be positively filled, his own descendants at the third or fourth generation might be practicing primitive rites of incantation, trembling in terror of witchcraft, and experimenting with ritualistic cannibalism. They might believe in voodoo, in shamanism, in taboo. He started almost guiltily. Yes, already there were beliefs in the tribe which approached the intensity of taboo, and he himself was inadvertently their chief author. There was the matter of Evie, for instance. He and Em and Ezra had talked it over long ago. They wanted no half-witted children of Evie's to be a care and drag. So they had made her, at least for the boys, a kind of untouchable. Evie, with her blonde hair and startled blue eyes, was perhaps the best-looking girl of them all. But Ish was sure that none of the boys had even seriously considered her. Probably they had no specific idea that anything would happen to them if they did, but such action was merely outside their scope of imagination. The prohibition was stronger than law. Such a one you could only call taboo. Again, there was all the allied matter of fidelity, always fearing the disruption of quarrels arising from jealousy. The older men had not so much taught marital fidelity as assumed it. Young people had been married at the earliest possible moment. Ezra's bigamy, having always been present, was not questioned. Although Ish did not doubt the utility of this practice for the particular situation, still, its acceptance as a matter of faith, rather than of reason, seemed to come close to taboo. The first violation, and there would surely be one, might bring a tremendous shock. A third possible example of taboo, though a minor matter perhaps, was the turning of the university library into a sacrosanct building. Once, when the oldest boys were youngsters, Ish had gone with them on a long walk which had taken them to the campus. While he was napping, two of them had worked loose a board which long before he had nailed across the broken window. They had gone into the stacks and started throwing books onto the floor. Horror-stricken with a sense of the violation of that great treasure house, Ish had followed them. He had been ashamed of himself later, but at the moment, he had been outraged beyond reason and had beaten the boys. The very unreasoning quality of his rage and horror must have impressed them much more than the beating. They had certainly passed this impression on to the younger children. The library had been safe, and Ish had been pleased. But this might also be called an example of taboo. And now he wondered. There was a fourth one, too, of course. But this brought him back to where he had started. He got out of the chair and went to the mantelpiece. The hammer was there as he himself had replaced it. He had not asked any child to take it back, not even Joey. He had preferred not to raise the issue again. There it stood, balanced on its 4-pound head of dull, rust-pitted steel. The hammer had been with him a long time. He had found it just before the rattlesnake had struck him, and so it might be called his oldest friend. It had been with him longer than Em or Ezra. He looked at it curiously, considering it carefully and self-consciously. The handle was actually in bad shape. It had weathered from lying so long in the open, and even before the hammer had been left to lie, the handle had apparently been banged accidentally against a rock and cracked a little. What was the wood? He really did not know. Ash or hickory, he supposed. Hickory, most likely. The simplest thing, he concluded impetuously, would be to get rid of the hammer. He could throw it into the bay. No, he reconsidered. That would be merely treating the symptom, not the disease. With the hammer removed, the children's tendency to superstition would still remain, and would merely fix upon something else, and perhaps take some more sinister form. He thought of destroying the hammer as a symbolical lesson to the children that it had no strength in itself. But he remembered that he did not actually have the power to destroy it. The handle he could burn easily, but the steel head was next to indestructible by any means at his disposal. Even if he found a carboy of acid and dissolved the steel in it, to go to so much trouble would make the children think that the hammer must really have possessed some deep-seated power. So he looked at the hammer with new interest, as something which was coming to have a life and power of its own. Yes, it had the qualities which went toward the making of a good symbol: permanence, entity, strength. Its phallic suggestion was obvious. Curiously, as he thought now, he had never named it. Though men were likely to give names to weapons, which also were symbols of power. Madelon and Brown Vess and Killdeer and Excalibur. Hammers had been signs of godhead before this. Thor had carried a hammer, probably other gods too. Among kings, there had been that old Frankish one who drove back the Saracens. Martell, they had called him. Charles of the Hammer. Ish of the Hammer. Thus, for one reason or another, when the children reassembled in school the next morning, Ish said nothing about superstition. It would be better, he told himself, to bide his time a little, to observe more closely for a day or two, or a week. Most of all, he wished to learn more about Joey. As the result of this observation, over a period of some weeks, Ish came to the conclusion, somewhat reluctantly, that Joey had many of the qualities of a first-class brat. He had passed his 10th birthday during the summer. His precocity was sometimes painful. He was, in the old phrase, too big for his britches. In age, he was halfway between Walt and Weston, who were 12, and Chris, who was 8. But Joey's precocity put him naturally into the company of the two older boys, and he and the younger one had nothing in common. This must be hard on Joey, Ish concluded, because he was always overreaching to attain the physical power of boys 2 years older and naturally stronger as well. Josie, his own twin, he neglected also, for he was at a stage when boys had no interest in girls, and Josie, besides, was not nearly so bright as he. There was thus, Ish saw, always a kind of strain about what Joey was doing or trying to do. Again and again, Ish thought of that little incident in which the other children had been afraid to pick up the hammer, but had acquiesced in Joey's doing something that they themselves did not dare to do. Obviously, in their minds, there was some kind of power inherent in Joey. Ish thought far back to the times of his studies, and he remembered the widespread belief that certain members of a tribe had a special power within them. Mana, the anthropologists had called it. Perhaps the children believed that Joey had mana. Possibly Joey himself believed it. Yet though Ish recognized Joey's limitations and disabilities and bad qualities, still he kept his thoughts centered more on Joey than on any of the others. Joey held the hope for the future. Only by the power of intelligence, Ish believed firmly, had mankind ever risen to civilization, and only by further exercise of that same power would mankind ever rise again. And Joey possessed intelligence. Possibly also he possessed that other power. Mana might be a fallacy of simple minds, but even the most civilized peoples had realized that certain individuals carried within them some strange power that went for leadership, Had anyone ever explained why certain men became leaders and others, though they seemed better qualified, did not? How much of all this did Joey realize? Many times Ish asked himself the question, but he could not as yet answer it. Yet more and more, as the summer progressed, he felt that in Joey lay the hope of the future. All mysticism aside, all idea of mana discounted, still, only Joey could keep the light burning through this dark time. Only he could store up and transmit the great tradition of mankind. But mere acquisition of knowledge was not all in which Joey excelled. Even though he was only 10, he was beginning to branch out for himself, to experiment, to discover things on his own. Indeed, that was the way he had really taught himself to read in the beginning. To be sure, all this development was still at a childish level. There was that matter of the jigsaw puzzles, for instance. The children had developed a sudden craze for the puzzles and had set about rifling some of the stores. Ish had watched them at their play, and at first, Joey had not been as good as the others. He seemed to lack some basic spatial sense. Sometimes he tried to join pieces which obviously did not fit, and the others indignantly told him so. Joey had been irked at his inferiority, and for a while had withdrawn from the game. Then Joey had suddenly got a new idea of how to go about it. He collected himself a number of pieces bearing the same shade of yellow, and thus was able to put them together more rapidly and make better progress than the other children. When he proudly displayed what he had done, the others were impressed. But even after he had explained his system, they did not want to adopt it. "What's the use anyway?" Weston had argued. "We might be able to do it faster your way, but it wouldn't be any more fun, and nobody cares how soon we get this finished." Betty had agreed. "Yes, it's no fun just going through all the work, picking up the yellow pieces and the blue pieces and the red pieces and putting them in different places." Joey, Ish noticed, could not put up a good argument for his method, and yet Ish could understand his motives. In the first place, granted, there was no need to finish the puzzle in a hurry, still to work efficiently was just as natural and as pleasant for Joey as not to crawl when he could walk. Besides, he had the competitive spirit, the old-time drive, so characteristic of Americans for getting to the front. Lacking a native gift for distinguishing shapes, really as much a physical endowment as having strong muscles, he had seen the way to take the lead by intellectual means. He had used his head, as they once had liked to say. Though the discovery was at all remarkable only because made by so young a child, still Ish was pleased to note that it was the discovery of one phase of classification, that basic tool of man's progress. Logic rested upon classification, language too, by its nouns and verbs grouping things and actions into neat, workable compartments. Only by his discovery of classification had man been able to impose some workable degree of order upon the infinite apparent disorder of the natural world. Ish saw Joey's experimental mind also at work with language. To him, language was not merely a practical matter, an unconscious implement used to express wants and feelings. Language to him was also a wonderful plaything. He had, for instance, a sense of puns and of rhymes, although none of the other children showed much interest in such things. He liked riddles. One day Ish heard him asking a riddle of the other children. "I made this one up myself," Joey was saying proudly. "Why are a man, a bull, a fish, and a snake all alike?" The other children were not much interested.
"Because they all eat things," Betty suggested languidly. "That's too simple," said Joey. "Everything eats things. Birds eat things too."
They made one or two other suggestions, and then there came up a suggestion to run off and do something else. Joey saw that he was in immediate danger of losing his audience. To prevent complete anticlimax,
he had to come out with his own answer. "Why, they're all alike because not one of them can fly." At the moment, Ish was not impressed with the riddle, but as he thought about it afterward, he felt that it was a highly developed and curious kind of 10-year-old mind which could evolve the idea of negative likeness. And into Ish's mind popped suddenly an old definition. Genius is the capacity for seeing what is not there. Of course, like every other definition of genius, that one could be shot to pieces also, because it obviously included the madmen as well as the genius. Yet there might be something in it too. The great thinkers of the world must necessarily have made their reputations by sensing what was not there and looking for it and discovering it. But the first requisite for making the discovery, unless it depended upon mere luck, was the realization that something unseen was there to be discovered, something lacking in the picture. This was Joey's summer for experiment, apparently. And one day he came home reeling strangely and with a strong smell of liquor on his breath. The story came out that he, along with Walton Weston, had visited one of the liquor stores in the nearest business district. This was a problem that Ish had often considered. He had once even gone into one of the stores and started opening and emptying the bottles. After an hour's work, however, he had found that he had made too little progress. The project was obviously impossible, and the children must take their chances with an unlimited liquor supply. And yet, when he thought about it, the situation for his children was not so different from that which he himself had experienced. In those days, his father had always had a shelf holding a bottle or two of whiskey and brandy and sherry, and there would have been nothing to stop Ish from carrying on a clandestine experiment of his own. He had not. And so also his own children and grandchildren apparently were not greatly attracted by the unlimited stores available to them. In fact, drunkenness had never been a problem in the community at all. Perhaps the simpler life they were leading took away the need for such stimulation. Or perhaps the mere fact that alcohol, like air, was free to everyone, removed the lure of difficulty which had previously surrounded it. As for Joey, Ish was pleased to see that the little fellow had still been sufficiently clever to drink only a small amount. Not enough to make him really sick, or even to make him pass out. He had obviously again been showing off before the older boys, and had again succeeded in impressing them. They had come home in worse shape than he. Nevertheless, Joey was definitely tipsy, and made no objection to being put immediately to bed. Ish took the opportunity to sit at the bedside and to deliver a lecture on the dangers of too much and too reckless experimentation, particularly if it was designed chiefly to show off before others. He looked down at the small face in the bed with its big eyes. There was intelligence in the eyes, and he knew that in spite of being tipsy, Joey was comprehending. There was also sympathy in the eyes, as if they were again saying to Ish, "We understand together. We both know things. We are not like these others." In a sudden flood of affection for his youngest son, Ish reached down and took one of the little hands in his own. He saw an answering look of affection come into the big eyes, and suddenly Ish knew that behind all the boyish bumptiousness, Joey was really a timid, sensitive child, just as he himself had once been. In fact, Joey's brashness was only the expression of timidity gone too far the other way. "Joey boy," he said impulsively, "why do you keep straining so hard? Weston and Walt, they're 2 years older than you are. Why don't you go easier? In 10 years, 20 years, you'll be way ahead of anything they can do." He saw the boy smile slightly, happily. But Ish knew that the happiness was merely from a newfound sympathy with his father, not at an impression that the words might have made. Any child, even a precocious one like Joey, lived in the present. To talk of 10 years away was merely, for a child, to talk of centuries. Ish looked at the little face again, and he saw the eyes roll slightly outward with drunkenness and sleepiness. And there was incongruity in the two. Yet Ish felt this love for his son welling up more strongly than ever within him. This one, he thought, is the child of the blessing. This one will carry on. He saw the eyes lose focus and the eyelids drop shut, and so he spoke no more, but he sat there by the bed, holding the hand in his own. Then, perhaps because sleep is so like death, a horrible fear swept in upon him. Hostages to fortune, he thought. When a man loved greatly, he laid himself open. He himself had had good luck. He had loved greatly with M, and now, again perhaps, with Joey. With M, he had had the luck. But then, one could never even think of M in terms of death. She was the stronger. With Joey, it was different. Holding the hand, he could feel the faint throb of the pulse in the wrist, and it seemed very close to the surface. A mere scratch would be enough. What were the chances for a little boy, not strong of body, driven on always by too powerful a mind? Yet this might be the one who could shape the whole future. He had only to grow in stature and in mind, to gain wisdom with the years, and to live. Between the plan and the fulfillment lies always the hazard. Heartbeat flutters, knife flashes, horse stumbles, cancer grows, more subtle foes invade. Then they sit around the fire at the cave mouth and say, "What shall we do, now that he is no longer here to lead us?" Or, while the great bell tolls, they gather in the courtyard and say, "It should not have happened so. Who is there now to give us counsel?" Or they meet at the street corner and say sadly, "Why did it have to be this way? Now, there is no one to take his place." Through all of history, it runs as a plaint. If the young king had not fallen ill, if the prince had lived, if the general had not so recklessly exposed himself, if the president had not overworked. Between the plan and the fulfillment stands always the frail barrier of a human life. Once more the fogs thinned out, and then came the first hot days. "I have seen it again," Ish thought to himself. "The great pageant of the year. Now is the time of dryness and death. Now the god lies dying. Soon the rains will come, and then the hills will be green. At last one morning I shall look out westward, here from the porch, and I shall see the sun setting far to the south. Then we shall all go together, and I shall carve the number into the rock. What shall we call this year, I wonder?" By now also it was time to be expecting Dick and Bob to return from their expedition in the jeep. Ish still worried and felt guilty sometimes at having allowed the boys to go, but now they had been gone so long that he was somewhat accustomed to the idea and did not feel the strain so much as he had earlier. And at the same time, he had another worry and sense of guilt that tended to counteract this one. The children. Their superstition and their ideas about religion. He had said to himself that all this would be easy to counteract. He had said that he would do something that next day. Yet all summer he had been flinching. Was it actually that he did not want to do anything? Did he really want the children to think of Joey as the possessor of some special power? Deep within himself, did he want the children to think of him, Ish, as a god? Not every day or every year could a man have reason to play with the intoxicating idea that he was becoming a god. Oh well, say at least a demigod, a being of some degree of special power. Ever since the incident of the hammer, he had been studying curiously the children's attitude toward him. It was changeable and uncertain. Sometimes, he sensed that feeling of awe which he had seen on that day of the incident with the hammer. He, like Joey, but even more so, had mana within him. He could perform strange feats. He knew the meanings of the puzzling words. He knew the curious ways of numbers. He knew by some strange power what the world was like, away beyond the horizon, out through the Golden Gate, that there were islands far in the ocean beyond the little rock tips of the Farallones, that they sometimes saw standing up above the horizon on clear days. The children, he came to realize, were not only children, but they were also unsophisticated and inexperienced as children in the old times had rarely been. None of them had ever seen more than a few dozen people. Though their lives, he believed, had been happy, they had been happy with the simplicity of a few satisfying experiences, repeated again and again. They had not suffered the continual shock of change, which had so affected children in the old days, both for good and for bad, making them nervous on the one hand and yet alert on the other. Children so unsophisticated might easily come to feel a certain dread of him, to regard him as a being with powers different from their own, not altogether earthly. At times he sensed this feeling and even saw definite evidences of it. Yet at other times, indeed generally, he was merely their own father or grandfather or Uncle Ish, a person they had known all their lives, with whom they had romped on the floor when they were little. They had no more respect for such a person than children ever had. In fact, the bigger ones already showed the adolescent feeling that the older man was blundering and quite obtuse. Perhaps they stood in some awe, but still they played tricks on him. Once, not a week after the incident of the hammer, they had set a tack for him in his chair, though that was one of the oldest of all tricks to play on a teacher. And again, after they had left the room with much suppressed giggling, Ish discovered that someone had worked that other old trick of pinning a strip of cloth to his rear so that it hung down like a white tail behind. Ish accepted such tricks in good spirit and did not attempt to find out which one of the children had done them or to inflict any punishment. In some ways, the tricks pleased him, for they showed him that the children considered him one of themselves. But the tricks also chagrined him a little. His ego was not above being pleased with the belief that he was a folk hero or demigod. Was this a way to treat a demigod? By putting tacks on his chair or pinning a tail on him behind? Yet, as he thought further, he realized that the two attitudes were not incompatible or altogether unprecedented. That is a strange thing, to be a god. They bring the fat ox with the gilded horns, and at your altar they strike him down with the poleaxe. You are proud of the sacrifice. But then they take head and horns and tail and hide, and in the hide they wrap the entrails. All this noisomeness they burn before your altar, and then go to feast themselves on the fat haunches. You see the deceit, and you are angry with a god's anger. You gather the thunderbolts, and your black clouds assemble. But so, you think then, they are my people. This year they are fat and proud and insolent, but who would wish his people to be mean and meeching? Next year, if there is pestilence, they will really burn the ox, nay, many oxen. So you pass it off, with only a little thunder, scarcely noticed in the pleasant confusion of the feasting. I am not stupid, you say to the sun. But there are times when a god should seem stupid. Then you wonder if you should have shared with him any secret of godship, but rather have looked for a convenient mountain to pile upon him. He is altogether too handy with a sickle these days. Even you terrible ones who call for human sacrifice, you too must wink. Ah, it is magnificently horrible. The shrieks of his wife and the moans of the victim and the flailing axes of the killers. There he lies, covered with blood, his tongue hanging out, a picture of loathsome death. Yet soon, in the confusion of the dance, he rises suddenly and dances with the others, and the red mulberry juice mingles with his sweat and disappears. Then you, the terrible one, must be a wise god and remember only the horror of the seeming death, though every child in the village knows you are tricked. No, there is no need to grovel and rub the face in the dirt. Merely bow the head as you enter, ever so slightly. Yet in the end, though he half feared the test, Ish could not resist an experiment. Perhaps the incident of the hammer had really meant nothing. He was curious. He picked the time carefully, late one morning, when it was only a few minutes before dismissal. He was preparing himself a retreat, if things got too embarrassing. There was no difficulty, since he was the teacher, in bringing a discussion around to the point where he could put the question casually enough. How was it, do you think, that all these things, he gestured widely with his hands, how was it that the world happened to be made? The answer came quickly. Weston was the spokesman, although apparently any of the children could have answered. Why, the Americans made everything. Ish caught his breath. Yet immediately he saw how the idea had arisen. After all, if a child asked who made the houses or the streets or the canned food, any of the older ones would have said naturally that the Americans did. He followed up with another question. And the Americans? What about them? Oh, the Americans were the old people. This time Ish found it a little harder to adjust quickly. In the old people, he sensed not merely a reference to time, but also something close to superstition. The old people. That had once meant fairies, people of the other world. That might be its meaning now again. Here was something he should work to counteract. He began simply. Then he paused and corrected himself, seeing no reason to use the past tense. I am an American. When he spoke, though they were the simplest of words, he had a curious feeling of pride come over him, as if flags were flying and bands playing. It had been a great thing in those old times to be an American. You had been deeply conscious of being one of a great nation. It was no mere matter of pride, but also there went with it a profound sense of confidence and security in life, and a comradeship of millions. Yet now, he had hesitated to speak in the present tense. In the silence of his pause, he saw the children looking at him, and then suddenly he sensed that his explanation had missed fire. He had merely been trying to explain that there was nothing supernatural in those old people who had been the Americans. He had tried merely to say, look at me, I'm Ish, father of some of you, granddad of one. I've rolled on the floor with you. You've mussed my hair. Yes, I'm only Ish. And now when I say I'm an American, I mean that there is nothing supernatural about Americans. They were only people too. This was what he had thought they would understand. But it had gone the other way around. When he had said, I am an American, they had nodded inwardly, interpreting, yes, naturally you're an American. You have many strange knowledges which we simple ones do not have. You teach us reading and writing. You tell tales about the world being round. You talk about numbers. You carry the hammer. Yes, it is plain that people like you made all the world, and you are merely one who lingers over from the old times. You are one of the old people. Yes, naturally, you are an American. As he looked about, almost wildly at this new thought, the silence was deep, and he saw Joey smiling at him. It was a knowing smile, as if Joey was saying, we two have something in common. I am like one of the old people who has been left over. I can read. I understand those things. Without being hurt, I carry the hammer. Ish was glad that he had had the foresight to ask his question just before noon. There was nothing he could muster now, either for question or reply. School dismissed, he said. School dismissed.
Chapter 6. One late afternoon, Ish was talking with Joey, or actually they were continuing Joey's education by means of play school. Ish had collected some money and was teaching Joey a little about history and the old economics. Joey liked the bright jingly nickels with the figure of the strange humped animal. As a young child would have done even in the old times, he preferred the nickels to the uninteresting bills with their picture of a bearded man who looked something like Uncle George. Ish was trying to find ways to explain. Just as he thought he had put the point across, he heard a strange and yet old and familiar sound. He lifted his head and waited tensely, mouth open to listen. It came again, much closer. The toot-a-toot-toot of a horn.
Hey, Em! He yelled. They're back!
He jumped up, letting the bills scatter from his hand to the floor. He and Em and the children all came rushing out, and there was a universal running and yapping of dogs just as the Jeep came down the road. It was dirty and travel-worn and banged about, but it had got through. Ish had still a moment of tension. Then the boys jumped out, yelling loudly, obviously alive and well. A sudden sense of profound relief let him know how much he had really been worrying about them. The boys stood there, surrounded by a little mob of yelling children. Ish held back, almost diffident. Then his eyes caught another movement. There must be someone else in the Jeep. Yes. Now the person was starting to get out. Ish had a sharp sensation of alarm, of resentment at the intruder. First, as the head was thrust out from the low door, Ish saw a bald crown and a brown beard, which would have been handsome if it had not been stained with tobacco and dirty-looking and scraggly around the edges where it had been haggled with scissors. The man stepped out and slowly straightened up. Ish, almost in panic, appraised him. A big fellow, tall and large-framed and heavy. He was powerful, and yet there had been little vigor in his movement as he straightened up. Yes, powerful, but with some inner trouble, and too heavy. The pudgy fat of the thick-featured face had squeezed in upon the eyes, narrowing them. Pig eyes, thought Ish, still in resentment. The children were milling around, and the man stood in their midst, just as he had stepped down from the car. He looked up and saw Ish, and their glances met. The man's little, fat, encroached eyes were bright blue. He smiled at Ish. Ish smiled back, though he raised the corners of his mouth only by conscious effort. Should have smiled first, he was thinking. He put me at my ease. I should have done it with him. He's powerful, even though his fat looks soft and unhealthy. Ish broke up the situation by striding forward to grasp Bob's hand. But even as he did so, the newcomer was still in his mind. About my age, he was thinking. Now Bob was making the introduction. This is our friend Charlie, he said simply, and he slapped Charlie on the back. Glad to see you, Ish managed to say, but even the old meaningless words did not slide out naturally. He looked straight at the narrow blue eyes, and in the tenseness of his look, there was perhaps a conscious defiance. No, those others were not pig eyes. Boar's eyes. Strength and ferocity behind the baby blue. As they shook hands, Ish felt his own grasp, the weaker. The other could have squeezed and hurt him if he had wished. Now Bob had taken Charlie away to introduce him to the others. Ish felt his resentment growing, not decreasing. Careful, he thought. But he had imagined the return as a reunion with no discordant elements. And here was Charlie. Handsome, no doubt, in a way. A good companion, so the actions of the boys seemed to testify. But yes, Charlie was dirty. That thought gave a background of rationality to the unreasoning dislike. Charlie was dirty,
and from inner reaction, Ish felt himself going on to think that Charlie must be in some way dirty inside, through and through, as well as outside. Dirt. The ever-present dirt of the earth, that was something which bothered Ish no more than it bothered anyone else these days, but the impression of dirt that Ish gained from Charlie was something different. Perhaps, he analyzed quickly, it was the clothes. Charlie was wearing what had in late years become a rarity. A business suit. He was even wearing the vest, because the afternoon was cold with low-drifting clouds. But the suit seemed greasy, and you would have said that it was egg-spotted, if there had been possibility of a man's having had eggs to eat recently. They all went trooping up to the house suddenly, Ish with them, not leading. The living room was jammed. The two boys and Charlie held the center. The children looked marveling at the boys, as explorers returned from a far expedition, and they eyed Charlie with as much wonder because they were unused to seeing any stranger. It was one of the biggest occasions that anyone could well imagine. Ish thought to himself it was a time to open champagne, if he had any ice. Then he wondered why the idea seemed ironic. Did you make it? Everyone was asking at once. How far did you get? What about that big city? What's its name? Yet in the midst of all the excitement, Ish felt himself sliding sidelong looks at the greasy beard and spotted vest, and gradually resenting Charlie more than ever. Watch your step, he thought to himself. You're just being the provincial. Resenting the intrusion of anyone else who may have different manners and ideas, you keep saying that the community needs the stimulation of new thoughts, and yet when someone else comes in, you start resenting him and rationalizing to yourself. Because you say, he's dirty on the outside, and so must have something dirty about him on the inside. Relax. This is a great day. Nevertheless, all thought of its being a great day went sour inside him. No, Bob was saying, we never got to New York. We got to that other big city, Chicago. But past there, the roads kept getting worse and worse. Trees grown up, trees fallen around everywhere, lots of washouts, bridges gone. So we had to shift one way or the other looking for... Someone cut in with another question before Bob could even finish his answer. There were half a dozen questions, each one canceling out the one before. In the hubbub, Ish caught Ezra's eye. In that glance, he seemed momentarily to sense danger, and he knew that Ezra, too, was watching Charlie. Ish felt himself both reassured and justified. Ezra knew people. Ezra liked people. If Ezra was so quickly perturbed at Charlie, there must be something about which to be wary. Ish trusted Ezra in such a case much better than he trusted himself. Come on, he thought again. You don't really know at all what Ezra's thinking. Maybe he's disturbed because he senses what you're thinking. And what's that? Maybe I'm only thrown off because I'm like any small tribesman, and fear the horrible stranger with his new ideas and his new gods to fight against mine. He brought himself back to what was being said. Wear funny clothes, he heard Dick's voice saying. Long white gowns, sort of. I don't know what you call them, and they have long white sleeves in them. The men and the women both wear them. They threw stones at us. They yelled, unclean, unclean. They kept crying, we are the people of God. They made us keep away. Then Em spoke. The rich roll of her voice, deep but feminine, seemed to cut in beneath the high-pitched, almost yelping noises of the excited little crowd. Any of the others would have had to pound on the table and shout for attention. For her, the room grew quickly quiet, even though she did not raise her voice and the words were commonplace. It's late, she was saying. Time for dinner. The boys are hungry. Half-witted Evie gave one last little senseless giggle, and then she too was quiet. Em was saying that everyone should go home now and come back later. Ish watched Charlie and saw that Ezra was still watching him, too. Charlie's eyes looked at Em perhaps a moment too long. His glance shifted to Evie's blonde hair and took on, it might have been,
an appraising look. Then everyone was getting up, starting to go. Dick took Charlie off to dinner at Ezra's. After dinner had been got on the table and they were seated, there were a great many questions to ask. Ish let Em do most of the talking with Bob. She had all the mother's worries to settle. Had they been sick, found plenty to eat, slept warm? Discussion of the trip itself was being reserved until the others returned after dinner, and Ish felt also that he should not pump Bob about Charlie. Yet he could not resist the temptation entirely, and Bob showed no reticence. "Oh," he said, "Charlie? Sure, we just picked him up about 10 days ago down near Los Angeles. There are quite a few people, I guess, living around Los Angeles. There are some all together, like us, and a few just scattered. Charlie was by himself." "Did you ask him to come along, or did he just come with you?" Ish watched carefully. He saw that Bob was surprised by the question, but apparently not disturbed. "Oh, I don't just remember. I don't know that I asked him. Maybe Dick did." Ish dived into his thoughts again. Perhaps Charlie had reasons for wanting to get from Los Angeles to some other place. No, that was merely slandering a man out of prejudice without trial. And then he heard Bob going on. "He tells lots of funny stories, Charlie does. He's a very good guy." Funny stories, yes. And one could imagine what kind. They were frank enough in all their language these days. The concept of obscenity, you might say, had disappeared, largely because there was only one word for things in their vocabulary, at least among the younger ones. Obscenity seemed to have died a natural death, possibly as a counterpart to the death of romantic love. But Charlie, he might still be able to tell a dirty story. Although Ish had never been a prude about stories, still, he felt his original resentment shifting to a kind of righteous indignation. In spite of his continually telling himself that he really knew nothing about Charlie, except the boy's opinions that he was a very fine person, Ish felt himself wishing that the water had never gone off and shocked them into doing something about the future, and thus bringing an outsider in among them. After dinner, they all built up a big bonfire on the hillside and gathered about it. There was much singing and skylarking of the youngsters. It was a time of celebration. There was much excitement, but the boys gradually got their story told. They had encountered only a few minor washouts and landslides on the highway to Los Angeles, nothing that the Jeep could not negotiate in four-wheel drive. The group of religious fanatics, wearing white nightgowns and calling themselves the People of God, lived in Los Angeles. They had focused upon religion, Ish assumed, under the influence of some strong leader who had happened to survive, just as in the tribe, for lack of such a leader, they had developed almost no interest in such things. Out of Los Angeles, the boys had taken 66 eastward, just as Ish remembered so vividly he had done in the days following the great disaster, when he had not been much older than the boys were now. The highway across the desert was easy and open, except for an occasional stretch where sand had blown across. They had gone along with no more trouble than blowouts here and there. The Colorado River Bridge they had found shaky but still passable. The next community was apparently at one of the old Indian pueblos near Albuquerque. From what he could make out from the boy's description, Ish concluded that most of the few dozen people at this little community were not very dark in complexion, but that the dominant spirit must be Indian, because their pattern of life was based on growing corn and beans, as the Pueblo Indians had done for many hundreds of years. Only some of the older people spoke English. This community also had drawn inward upon itself and looked with suspicion upon the strangers. The people there had horses. They did not drive automobiles, and they rarely went into any town. From there, the boys had swung north to Denver, and then out eastward across the plains. "We followed a road," said Bob. "It's like 66, only just part of it." He paused, hesitant. Ish thought for a minute and then realized that the boy was trying to describe Highway 6. Some of the markers would still be standing along it, and Bob had sensed that they were the same shape as the numerals on 66, although there was only one of them. Ish was embarrassed that his own son was not sure of the numerals. Highway 6 had led them on through the corner of Colorado and across the plains of Nebraska. Lots of cattle everywhere. Here Dick was taking up the story. Cattle everywhere. You always see cattle. Did you ever see the big brown ones with humps on their shoulders? Asked Ish. Yes. Once we saw a few of them, said Dick. How about the grass? Does any of it grow straight and stiff-looking, with a head on the end and little grains forming? When you went through, they should have been still soft and milky, perhaps. When you came back, you might have seen it somewhere standing all golden, with the grain hard. We called it wheat. No, we saw nothing like that. And how about corn? You know what that is. They were growing it there by the Rio Grande. No, there is no corn growing wild anywhere. Onward still they had gone, finding the roads now blocked more often, since they had come to the wetter country with ranker and faster growth and heavier rains, combined with hard frosts in winter. The highways were splitting up into great chunks and blocks as the frost worked under them. Wherever the surface was cracked, grass and weeds and even bushes and young trees were springing up to block the way. Yet they had crossed what was once Iowa. We came to the big river, said Bob. It is the biggest of all, but the bridge was good. They had come to Chicago. But it was a mere desert of empty streets. It would be an inhospitable place, thought Ish, when the winter wind swept in from Lake Michigan. He was not surprised that people, with the whole continent to choose from, had drifted away from the once great city by the lake, leaving it ghost-like behind. Leaving Chicago, the boys had lost themselves in the maze of roads in the outskirts and had ended up, the day was cloudy and they lost direction, by going south instead of east. After that, said Bob, we got one of these things out of a store. It points direction. And he looked at Ish for the word. Yes, a compass, said Ish. We hadn't needed one before, but now we used it and got going east again, until we came to the river we couldn't cross. Ish figured out quickly that it might have been the Wabash. Floods of 22 years, or more likely just one great flood, had swept away the bridges. After exploring southward and finding no passage, the boys had to go northward to Highway 6 again, which more or less followed a height of land. The progress eastward had become more and more laborious. Floods, windstorms, and frost had transformed the once open and smooth highways into rough lines of concrete chunks strewn with gravel from washouts, overgrown with vegetation, and crisscrossed with fallen tree trunks. Sometimes the jeep could push through the bushes or detour the tree trunks. But often the boys had to make a passageway with axe or shovel, and the constant work wore them down. Also, the loneliness began to oppress them. There was a cold day with a north wind, Dick confessed, and we were afraid. We remembered what you used to tell us about the snow, and we thought we might never get home. Somewhere, probably near Toledo, they had turned back. At turning back, a kind of panic came upon them. At the same time, heavy rains began to fall, and the roads were often flooded. They had the fear that some of the bridges over the larger rivers might be carried away, leaving them cut off from their own people. They had not tried to go south, as Ish had wished, but had backtracked along their own trail, gradually being reassured by their ability to get back to places that they had seen already. On their return home, therefore, they had learned little that they had not learned on the way east. Ish did not blame them at all. In fact, he thought that they had acted with great determination and intelligence. He blamed himself, if anyone, for sending the boys toward Chicago and New York, the great cities of the old times. He might have done better to have chosen some southern route toward Houston and New Orleans, instead of a route into the inhospitable country of northern winters. And yet, east of Houston at least, floods would have been more severe, and growth of vegetation much more rapid than farther north. Because of the climate, Arkansas and Louisiana